journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, March 22nd, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Obama caves on the Keystone Pipeline project, even as California's stealth fracking industry is exposed. Teacher of the Year Florence Avignon on her one-woman play, and Green Party activists gear up for this year's election. But I can't help myself. Why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Obama is expected to announce his approval for partial construction of the controversial Keystone XL tar sands pipeline in Cushing, Oklahoma, today. Under a deadline imposed by Congress, Obama in January did not approve a permit for the 1,700-mile pipeline slated to run from Alberta, Canada, to the U.S. Gulf Coasts. Environmentalists and a broad coalition of groups opposing the project celebrated that move with caution. The administration remained open to future proposals, and at that time, the State Department announced, quote, the denial of the permit application does not preclude any subsequent permit application or applications for similar projects. Since then, the Canadian energy company TransCanada continued their plans for the Keystone Pipeline. Today, as part of a tour to drum up enthusiasm for his energy policy, the president is expected to throw his support behind the construction of the southern half of Keystone, a 485-mile line that will carry domestic crude oil from Cushing, Oklahoma, to the Gulf of Mexico. A White House official said on Tuesday that this leg of the project will, quote, relieve a bottleneck of oil and bring domestic resources to market. Republicans decried the rejection of Keystone in January, but have used the recent jump in gas prices to call on the president to increase domestic oil and gas production. News of the scaled-down project brought jeers from Republican GOP candidates. Rick Santorum called for drilling on federal land, and Newt Gingrich dismissed the announcement as a campaign stunt. Here in California, Governor Jerry Brown also faces pressure to increase energy supplies. The LA Times reported last week that Brown fired two regulators last year when permits for oil drilling in the state were delayed. Oil derricks have long dotted the California landscape, but for years now, oil and gas have been inconspicuously drilled and extracted from beneath the ground through hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Fracking for gas has gotten much attention in the Northeast and Rocky Mountain areas, where it has been blamed for causing earthquakes and contaminating drinking water with flammable chemicals. But studies on the prevalence and negative effects in the Golden State are just now being released. My guests include Jamie Henn, Communications Director at 350.org, and Bill Alayo, who is the Director of Government Affairs for California at the Environmental Working Group. Welcome to Uprising, Jamie and Bill.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Jamie, let me start with you regarding the Keystone XL pipeline. When we had covered the story in January of President Obama's refusing to approve the permit, it was seen as a victory, but there was certainly a lot of caution. And it seems as though any sense of victory was probably premature, given the knowledge that we have now that he's going to approve the southern half of the pipeline. Is this interpret the president's actions as trying to slip something under the door while activists might not be paying as much attention across the country?
Well, the Keystone XL pipeline is certainly proving to be the zombie that never dies and comes back and back. By all means, the work that everybody did last fall and the announcement this winter was a real victory. It stopped the entire project that had been slated to be built. Before those protests started, 97% of energy insiders polled by some leading magazines thought this pipeline would be a shoo-in. What's happening right now is that the president is endorsing the southern part of the Keystone XL pipeline. It's important to remember that that southern part doesn't require a federal permit. So this portion of the pipeline actually would have been built years ago if TransCanada hadn't tied it to the northern segment of the pipeline that does require that presidential permit to cross the federal border. So in reality, there's little the president is announcing today. He can't really do anything to expedite the pipeline. The pipeline was going to be built anyways, and the opposition to that southern leg that is happening in Texas and Cushing and other places will continue. This pipeline is going to be met with lawsuits. It's going to be met with landowner resistance. And I would still put my money on some of these projects not being built. You know, today is disappointing because the president has a lot to celebrate. He has policies that are making a difference. But this sort of kind of Sarah Palin energy policy of drill everywhere that he's putting out there is really just a flashback to the types of moves that got us into this mess. We have 2% of the world's oil. We consume 20% of it. There's no way we are going to drill our way out of this problem. And this is, I think, a really misguided move by the White House. It makes him look like a flip-flopper, and it's exactly the wrong thing that he needs to be doing heading into this election.
Well, let me turn to Bill. Now, this project that has gotten so much national attention is not necessarily directly related to what's happening in California, but California is the fourth largest oil producing state in the country. And while our listeners may have heard of this term fracking or hydraulic fracturing, it's generally associated with releasing gas and extractions in other parts of the country, in the eastern parts of the country, the Rocky Mountains. How prevalent is fracking in California as a practice?
It's a good question. When I saw Gasland shortly thereafter, I thought of the same question. Were we doing this in California? And I know we have a lot of natural gas production right around where I live, Sacramento. But some research showed that very little fracking for gas was done here because it's really not needed because of the geologic formation. But we started to uncover that fracking for oil had occurred here for over 40 years. Started in Los Angeles. It's commonly used in Kern County. It's even done offshore in the Santa Barbara Channel under water. So we found more and more evidence. And the first place you would go, of course, is to our own state regulatory agency, the Division of Oil and Gas, and there was nothing on their website. I go, well, why not? And they basically, for the next year and a half, have focused on and denied that we frack for gas in California, and I'm not sure why they do this, because we've shown them, look, we're fracking for gas. The oil companies themselves are very open about the fact that they frack for oil on a common occurrence. Halliburton, the world's largest fracking company, told us they frack 50 to 60% of the wells that are drilled in Kern County today.
And remind our listeners of what the dangers are. If this is a more common practice than was thought in California, are our drinking water supplies protected?
Well, so far we haven't seen damage from fracking in California, but you know what? No one's looking for it. Because our state agency doesn't regulate it, you don't need a permit to do it, you don't need to tell them when you do it, where you do it, how many chemicals you use, how much water you use, we cannot track it. We don't know where it is. Now, having said that, we hope that damage hasn't been done. And if you see Gasland, the movie, or read about fracking, which is basically a story a day from across the country, there has been groundwater pollution. Methane gas has migrated up from the lower formations into people's drinking water. There's also something that may get a little underplayed, which is the potential to spill chemicals or a well blowout, and that's happened back east. And the chemicals they use in fracking can be really nasty. Many of them appear on our Proposition 65 list. They're carcinogenic. They're toxic. So we don't want them released, and we should be tracking where they're put, when they're injected, and what happens to them after they come up. Is they so-called produced water, when you drill for oil, you bring up water from down below, or the water you injected to make the process work, what happens to that water afterwards?
Right. Turning back to Jamie Henn, the issue of pollution is, of course, a major, major factor in environmentalist opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline, not just from the pollution that would result from increased consumption of oil, but even from the leaks to the massive pipeline that were all but guaranteed over a number of years. Tell us about the public opposition. 350.org, your organization organized, was among the leading groups to organize opposition against the Keystone XL pipeline with historic protests in Washington, D.C. last year. How are people responding to the news of the southern leg of the pipeline that may be approved very soon?
Well, I think that we're seeing a lot of people around the country really frustrated with the president, but also fired up to really go after the root of the problem. You know, this was a coalition effort from the very start. This fight really began in the tar sands in Canada with Indigenous and First Nation opposition to those projects. As the pipeline route was proposed, that opposition extended through states like Nebraska, where farmers and ranchers really stood up and said, we don't want a foreign oil company ramming this pipeline through our land, especially a pipeline that's going to be carrying this dirtier, more toxic tar sands oil. You know, the first Keystone pipeline, the Keystone One, spilled 12 times in the first year it was in operation. One of those biggest spills, another tar sands spill on another pipeline, was up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where they're still cleaning up the residue of that disaster. So I think people are really worried about the pipeline moving forward, any part of it, be it the kind of northern route carrying tar sands out from Canada or the southern route that President Obama will be talking about today. You know, I think there's a real connection here, though, between this pipeline and the fracking that our other guest was talking about. You know, these fights have been connected for a long time. Josh Fox, who directed Gaslands, was very involved in the protests against Keystone XL at the White House. We've been working really closely with him ever since. And I think that people are beginning to see that all of these extreme energy projects, be they fracking for natural gas or mountaintop removal or big coal export facilities or pipelines like Keystone XL, these fights are really connected. And I think that more and more the environmental movement is seeing that a pathway forward, both out of necessity and out of a way of building a stronger movement, is going to be taking on these projects, being honest with people about what's happening in America right now, and really trying to put forward some bold solutions. So I think that, you know, people will be disappointed by the speech no matter what, but also really fired up for the fights ahead.
Bill Alio, the position of Governor Jerry Brown is something that also needs, I think, to come up. And as I mentioned, that he had essentially fired two regulators last year when permits for oil drilling in California were delayed, and is very much supportive, it seems, of the oil and gas industry here in California. Is the issue of fracking also something that can be linked to Governor Jerry Brown, or is this something that corporations are doing essentially by themselves because there's been so little information out there and essentially so far nobody holding them accountable?
Yeah, and when he fired the two people, people asked me, boy, was this because of the fracking thing, that the agency had basically turned a blind eye to regulation of fracking? I said, I don't think so. The oil companies went into Jerry Brown right after he got elected to complain about the speed of the processing of permits. So I don't think it's related there. And it's clear that fracking has been on for decades, way before Jerry Brown was. Actually, it was being done when he was in office the first time.
Wow.
And the state agency has, for some reason, decided they're not going to regulate it. And the reasons are they give for why not are bogus or misleading. And they, for example, they say, well, it's a well stimulation technique that's only short term. We say, whether it's 4 hours, 4 days, or 40 months in a row, don't you think someone ought to be overseeing this and, you know, finding out where, what chemicals, tracking it so a member of the public can see this? Say you live next door to a well that was fracked. It'd be a good idea if you knew that, so that, say, benzene or some other chemical showed up in your well 6 months later, you could start to connect the dots and say, maybe this was the next-door fracking operation. But again, I said, we don't have the horror stories going on in other states with people lighting their taps on fires and things, and thankfully we don't, but we think it's high time that our Division of Oil and Gas get on top of this and not keep saying, well, we don't really need to frack in California. They just keep saying that. Yesterday at a hearing here on their budget, they said our geology is different than what you see back east in this Gasland stuff. So what? We frack for oil in California. Yes, we aren't fracking for gas in California, although, interestingly, a few wells have been fracked in the gas fields of California as the companies explore that technology and to see whether they can get higher rates of gas from older deposits out. And this is basically right under the division's nose. I mean, within 30, 40 miles of their headquarters, wells have been fracked. I think if we push them, they said, yeah, we know they have. And I said, why don't you regulate it? There's no good answer.
Hmm.
And it hasn't been, well, the last 2 or 3 years of overwork, they're trying to get to that. It's been decades of benign neglect. And the oil companies, interesting enough, are wide open about it. They've testified at hearings, said, yeah, we've been fracking for 40 years.
Hmm.
We have nothing to hide, and we want to see a law passed, and we're working on that. And it's been the Division of Oil and Gas that's been stubbornly coming along saying, all right, we frack here. Maybe we should do something, but we're not going to until we're forced to.
Right. And that, of course, brings up the issue of citizen involvement. And I should also mention Halliburton, a company that has its tentacles spread far and wide, blocked a disclosure bill last year in California that would have required that landowners are notified when their land is being fracked, essentially the hydraulic fracturing on or near their land. And that's pretty amazing. Because if this disclosure isn't happening, then one has to wonder what is being hidden. Jamie Henn, let's talk about what's next on a national level for the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline. Are there future plans for major mobilizations to hold not just President Obama, because as you said, his approval isn't actually needed for the southern part of the pipeline, but to essentially hold now states accountable?
Well, there's going to be, I think, two phases of this fight going forward. The one is really focused on the Keystone XL pipeline itself and blocking the pipeline along its route. So there's a lot of work that will be happening in the state level, both on the southern route of the pipeline, where folks are really concerned about the project going through their land. You know, I'm actually watching a Facebook chat right now, live feed on the White House site, and people are sharing stuff saying, this section of the pipeline is going to go through my neighbor's land. You know, we're going to be there. We're going to try and stop it. So I think that people really are mobilizing at the local level to try and stop the project. The other important piece of this fight, though, is understanding that we can't really fight pipeline by pipeline forever, that it's really important to take these projects on one by one. We'll continue to do that. But that we also really need to go to the root of the problem, which is one of the reasons why 350.org and a lot of other people are really looking at how can we begin to try and get this dirty energy money out of politics, which is causing a lot of this. And I think one of the first steps is bringing that heat to our elected officials when they come back on recess this April 2nd, getting out into town halls, going to campaign offices, really pushing our elected officials on the favors that they keep doing for the fossil fuel industry. Almost every member of Congress is taking quite a bit of money from these corporations, be they the natural gas companies that want to frack or the coal companies that want to blow up our mountains in Appalachia. Increasingly, with Occupy, with other movements out there, we can begin to put together a real coalition to work on this issue and go after things like fossil fuel subsidies that are making a lot of this possible. So I think we need those two prongs. Continue to do that very important work at the local level. Everybody in California should be getting engaged in these fracking fights, as well as continue to work for the national political change that we need to really begin to tilt the balance back towards renewable energy and stop this extreme fossil fuel energy that really is beginning all across America right now.
And I should mention that there's going to be a major protest today at Oklahoma State University against the speech, against the announcement and President Obama's backing of the acceleration of the southern part of the Keystone XL pipeline. I want to thank you, Jamie Henn, as always, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jamie Henn is communications director at 350.org. 350.org is where you can find more information. Finally, Bill Alayo, you're the director of government affairs for California at the Environmental Working Group. Is there action happening at the state level here against fracking, or are we still in the phase where groups like yours are gathering information?
Well, we have a bill, Assembly Bill 591, that did get stalled last year. It was sailing along till Halliburton came in and said they had concerns about the trade secret provisions, the revealing of these chemicals, and they want to sometimes to keep them fully secret from the public. We're still negotiating that bill this year, and I think we'll still have a bill later this year.
And what does that bill do specifically?
The bill says, report to the Division of Oil and Gas, who will then post it where you, when you fracked a well, where that well is, the chemicals you injected, and then a little different from other states, we also require the water reported to where you got the water from, how much you used, and what happens to it, and lastly, whether you injected any radioactive tracers into the ground and what happens to those as part of the produced water or oil. They use these tracers with have very short half-lives to help understand the underground strata or geologic formations.
So it's mostly a disclosure bill. And that's
exactly.
AB 591. Give out information for the Environmental Working Group.
Yeah, our website's really easy. It's EWG.org. And we have great information on there, too, about personal care products, sunscreens, your cell phone radiation levels. People who go to our website often come back many times. And we have our recent reports on fracking at the national level, and our California report on fracking is there, which reveals the neglect of the state agency in regulating this process, which has potential for polluting surface and groundwaters.
And that's EWG.org. Bill Alayo, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Bill Alayo is the Director of Government Affairs for California at the Environmental Working Group. We'll post the websites we mentioned on uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll be joined in studio by Marcy Winograd, who will share with us why she recently switched from the Democratic to the Green Party. Also with us, Mike Malinin, drummer for the Goo Goo Dolls and a Green Party member, will discuss the Green Party's agenda for this election year. After this short break, Florence Avignon joins us. She is California's 2012 Teacher of the Year. She'll be discussing her new one-woman play. Stay tuned.
KPFK's local station board chairman Michael Novick will be making an on-air report to the listener on Thursday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. Along with the report, Michael will be taking listener phone calls during the hour. This is your opportunity to ask about the local station board's activities, show your support for the station, and let us know what you like and don't like about what we do at KPFK. The report to the listener is live on air on Thursday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. with local station board chairman Michael Novick on Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
The board of the Los Angeles Unified School District voted recently to close a $500 million budgetary shortfall by proposing to increase class sizes, cut after-school programs, early childhood education, and adult education. The plan, a worst-case scenario, would go into effect only if voters refuse to pass a $298 annual per capita parcel tax. Both the school board and those protesting outside the meeting where the plans were discussed blame the state government for funding cuts. What often gets left out of such discussions are the real impacts that public school programs have on vulnerable youth populations. Today, we feature the story of one LAUSD teacher, Florence Avignon, a literacy specialist teacher at Phoenix Academy and the Los Angeles County Office of Education, focusing primarily on kids that nearly everyone else has given up on, such as those residing in drug rehabilitation facilities. She has also taught at Central Juvenile Hall, teaching incarcerated youth. Florence Avignon, herself a product of the public school system, raised by a single mother and who benefited from the welfare system as a child, uses literature as one of her teaching tools. Avignon was recently recognized for her teaching work, being named California's 2012 Teacher of the Year. Her one-woman play, Making Us Whole, a tribute to literary activists, opens this Friday as part of Women's History Month and features works by such African-American literary giants as Langston Hughes, Alice Walker, Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Maya Angelou, and many others. I had a conversation with Florence Avignon recently about her play and her teaching work. Welcome to Uprising, Florence Avignon.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
So first, tell us a little bit about your background before we get into your one-woman play, Making Us Whole, a tribute to literary activists. How much of your own education and childhood education has led you to where you are today writing and performing this play?
Wonderful question. I was influenced by writers who I discovered had experienced much of what I discovered as a kid. I grew up as a single parent child, the youngest of four girls. Never saw my father ever. We were on welfare. And so quite often you grow up thinking that there are potholes in your life. And then when you read literature and there's some 12-year-old girl in New York going through the same thing that I'm going through, and yet they've overcome their struggle, and not only overcome their struggle, but they are thriving because they're writers and they're adults, you become inspired. And so literature had a huge impact and aiding me in overcoming my struggle or any of those potholes that I referenced as a kid.
Mm. And so a tribute to literary activists is how you describe your one-woman play. What is a literary activist?
Well, you know, minority writers in particular often have a very unique story because what they do is identify the political, social, and economic struggles of our communities. And that's sort of an activism, I believe, because quite often that was the only vehicle that many of them could actually express themselves through. When we think of like the Harlem Renaissance, and Langston Hughes is also referenced in my play. So I see them as literary activists because they use the power of the words to change, to mobilize, and to inspire urban communities.
So what you're saying is that somebody who comes from a community that as a whole experiences oppression, writing is, and just speaking out, is in and of itself a form of activism.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that quite often we hesitate to pay tribute to those individuals, just as modern day reporters are often activists because they expose and reveal struggles that are occurring throughout the world. And quite often we are hesitant to pay tribute to those individuals. And because my writers are getting up there in age, I don't like when we pay tribute to people once they leave us. Mm-hmm. Quite often, that's when you hear of all the fanfare.
Right.
So I wanted to personally pay tribute, to give my appreciation in this moment of me being honored as a teacher. I don't think I would be here without their literature and their inspiration. So I actually spoke with each of these individual writers who are my highlighted items in the play. That's Miss Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, and Intozaki Shange. And I felt very, very fortunate now as an adult person who was influenced as a kid to have them give me permission to share their works.
Mm. So did you grow up reading Nikki Giovanni and others?
Absolutely. I grew up a very, despite being very poor and struggling as a young girl, four and three older sisters, I also grew up in a household in which I couldn't go outside very often. So literature became my social life. I became very active in sharing literature. I was on the speech team. I probably wouldn't have gotten through college if I wasn't on the speech team, and I won a couple of scholarships for speech. But it was just my vehicle to share the words of these various authors.
And what did it feel like for you reading somebody like Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni as a young girl, thinking about the fact that these women were world-renowned,
right,
but in a very intimate way speaking to you, not only as a woman, but as a black woman?
Yes, absolutely. Again, it was my inspiration, and I think that's probably why I ended up teaching both history and English, because definitely literature always has a historical reference. And I became intrigued by elements of history, and definitely the ability to have students get into a short story or a novel and have them make personal connections, and particularly the population that I teach. Quite often they feel as if they're the only ones going through their struggle. Literature teaches you that your struggle is global, and that if someone over in Somalia can overcome violence, then you can too in your community. Mm-hmm. And I try to do that now as an educator, just as these authors were able to do that for me when I was a young girl.
And I want to ask you about your experiences as a teacher, but first, so tell us more about Making Us Whole. This is a one-woman play, mm-hmm. And it features some of the original works by these women that have inspired you.
Yes.
So how do you put it all together?
Yes.
What would listeners who went to watch you expect on the stage?
Right. Well, I am actually portraying about 12 different characters. Mm-hmm. A reverend, a little girl. I portray a woman who speaks out against the injustices and atrocities facing young girls throughout the world. I have very sassy women who talk about being able to be independent and not have their spirit taken away by a man. So I play a myriad of characters, and I do that intentionally. So you're laughing, you're dancing. It's definitely intertwined with music, and the music is also period pieces that will bring memories back for the audience. And I also have dancing because I think movement is a part of that expression. And it's sort of the tradition, I guess, again, of the Renaissance, where you had music and movement as well as literature. I've tried to bring that back through this production. I have teachers as dancers, some of the performers. There are three dancers. One of the dancers is actually a former district teacher of the year.
Mm.
So I've intertwined a great deal of art to bring literature to life. I have a media element where there are news clips, because what I've done is actually identify pieces of work that many people have never heard. While I do showcase some of the, shall I say, classical sections of literature from Nikki and Langston, I also pay tribute to pieces that were very powerful but never heard. And I want to make sure people know how brilliant these authors have been.
And so it's not just women authors.
No, it's not. It's primarily women authors. I have Peter Deonda, who had a wonderful play called Ladies in Waiting, and it's a monologue, a very poignant monologue, about a woman and how she ends up in jail. I don't want to give away too much, but it's a very powerful piece. So Peter Deonda and Langston Hughes, I think, are the only two, no, and Paul Lawrence Dunbar. So I have three males, but it's a preponderance of female authors.
Can you share with our listeners an excerpt from this play, Making Us Whole, a tribute to literary activists?
Great, definitely. There's one powerful selection from a selection called Boogie Woogie Landscapes by Entozaki. This particular piece addresses the atrocities women are facing throughout the world. So here's a brief excerpt. Even though gender is not destiny, right now being born a girl is to be born threatened. I want being born a girl to be a cause for celebration, a cause for protection and nourishment of our birthright, to live freely with passion, knowing no fear. We are born girls to live to be women who have our own lives, to live, to have our own lives, to live. We are born girls to live to be women.
Florence Avignon is my guest, performing a very tiny taste of her one-woman play, Making Us Whole, a tribute to literary activists. The play has only four performances, March 24th and 25th, and then the 31st and April 1st at the Imagined Life Theater at 5615 San Vicente Boulevard in Los Angeles. And we'll give information about how you can get tickets a little bit later in the program. But performances are Saturdays and Sundays for two weekends in a row starting March 24th. Saturdays at 7 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Actually, so there's three performances a day over four days.
Weekend, yes.
There we go. So now tell us a little bit about how these pieces that you put together, that you got the permission from these various authors, how did you link them? And did you sort of stitch some kind of a narrative or a trajectory throughout the play so that it makes sense from start to finish?
Right. Well, sort of, but I didn't want to do the traditional sort of chronological approach. What I did were thematic looks, things that were, they may have been issues in the news, they may have been major. For example, there's a selection in which it's sort of humorous. The Reverend is trying to talk about freedom, but it's during slavery. So it's humorous because while the only time slaves could often convene on the plantation was in church settings, and a lot of folks don't know, that's why African-American churches are so popular in our community, because it's a tradition, it's historical. That was the only time slaves could convene, was for religious purposes. So that vehicle was used politically. And that's why I talk about the idea of literary activism, because Paul Lawrence Dunbar was brilliant in writing a sermon and having a reverend talk about freedom biblically, but actually trying to get the slaves to consider getting their freedom.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your teaching. You were announced as one of the California Teachers of the Year, and you're a literary specialist teacher at Phoenix Academy and the Los Angeles County Office of Education. What sort of, how does your work kind of bring you in touch with kids that might be going through what you went through as a kid?
Right. Well, I have been very, very fortunate for the last 20 years. I initially started with LA Unified at my alma mater, Crenshaw High School. I began to wonder what happened to those kids who were suddenly expelled or transferred. As a result, I discovered they were incarcerated or sent to other sites because they couldn't come onto regular school grounds. And so I opted to teach that population of students. So I presently teach students who are actually in drug rehabilitation facilities. They live there. Prior to this year, I taught at Central Juvenile Hall, which is an incarcerated facility. These students, more than any, need to be inspired.
Why did you want to teach them?
Well, one, I always like teaching those students that teachers often feel are no longer teachable.
So the students that we all give up on.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I do that because I guess I have seen so many miracles. While at Crenshaw, I had students in foster care who were active on my speech team. And that involvement gave them hope. I guess very much like basketball gives some young men hope, and football, the ones who don't have fathers, it becomes their vehicle for having role models and so forth. I found that art is an outlet for a lot of students. And I had a lot of poets, both in Central as well as Crenshaw, and they just needed an outlet for the poetry. So I've used literature as a tool to awaken hope in students. I've used it as a tool for students to get up and express themselves, very much like, and I reference this in my play, rap. While many students absolutely adore hip-hop, and Tupac in particular, a lot of them don't know that he began as a poet, that he actually went to a school for the arts, and that his love was poetry and performance. And so once I get them to understand that expressing themselves is a vehicle to get rid of anger, and that that was one of the vehicles that poets like Tupac and other hip-hop artists use, they begin to get more into literature. They begin to delve more into connecting with authors and short stories. They begin to find personal connections to stories that may be classics but still have some connection to their personal struggles. Mm-hmm. And so I am very honored each day to use my gift as a teacher to give hope to students. And I really see teaching as a vehicle to building my future, not just their future.
Finally, Florence Avignon, you mentioned that when you were a child, you're a child of a single parent, and
yes,
you were on welfare. And it's, yes, you know, it's amazing because this concept of welfare is constantly in the news these days, ever since Reagan,
right,
and Clinton, and now the demonization of welfare,
yes,
as some kind of handout or freebie that ordinary struggling people are getting.
Right.
How does that make you feel? Somebody,
right,
who you know, needed help from the government.
Absolutely.
And got it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you're still here. You're working. You're Teacher of the Year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think wonderful. I really think people do not understand, one. I think part of the issue with not understanding welfare is not understanding the fact that we live in this wonderful nation in which we're supposed to help those individuals who aren't unable to help themselves completely.
For no fault of their own, usually.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, because the attitude is, if you're on welfare, it's because you're lazy, or you're on welfare and it's going to make you lazy.
And I think that sort of erases the historical reference as to why certain populations have historically needed welfare. And mm-hmm, that's as a history teacher, we can't ignore that. And even when I teach history, I always advocate to students that let's understand why and then figure out solutions as to how to move on. There's a reason why I had to grow up on welfare. My mom had to stop school early because she lived in a city in which people like her, African Americans, couldn't get the best jobs. And she had to assist her mom. And as a result, like many other students, they couldn't afford to continue schooling because they needed to work. Ironically, even my mom preferred that I get a job instead of going to college because she thought that was much more of a secure financial backing. So welfare created this opportunity for me because I realized that I was given something to assist me.
Right.
And as a result, I now needed to assist others. So while I made it a point to avoid going back on welfare because I used a public education in order to allow me to become successful, I realized that it was this rotation of my nation helped me, now I help my nation. And that was the concept of me using public assistance and free education to become an independent individual who could now come back and pull someone else up. And if we remove those opportunities, then we're removing opportunities for somebody else to be Engineer of the Year or another Teacher of the Year,
right,
or a Lawyer of the Year.
Well, Florence Avignon, I want to wish you the best of luck with your play and with your teaching. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Florence Avignon is a literacy specialist teacher at Phoenix Academy and the Los Angeles County Office of Education. Making Us Whole, a tribute to literary activists, her one-woman play, will be performed on four dates only, starting Saturday, March 24th. And we have two pairs of tickets to that opening night to give away to our listeners right now at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. The first two callers will get a pair of tickets to see Florence perform on Saturday, March 24th at 7 p.m. The other dates are Sunday, March 25th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., Saturday, March 31st at 7 p.m., and Sunday, April 1st at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. The play is at the Imagined Life Theater, 5615 San Vicente Boulevard in Los Angeles, and you can call 951-313-8012 for tickets. That's 951-313-8012. If you don't win tickets, at 818-985-KPFK. Also check uprisingradio.org for a link to purchase tickets online later today. This is Uprising. After this short break, we'll take a look at the Green Party. Stay tuned.
Wanting this world to let you in, and you stand there, a frozen light in dark and empty streets, and you smile, hiding behind a God-given face, and I know you so much more. Everything they ignore is all I need to see, and you're the only one.
Let Love In by the Goo Goo Dolls. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney won the Illinois primary race for the GOP presidential nomination on Tuesday, giving him yet another edge over his closest rival, Rick Santorum. Winning a majority of that state's 69 delegates, Romney is now closer to securing the GOP nomination, even as he deflects the fallout from recent remarks made by his campaign manager on the extremist positions of his party. Eric Fernstrom, speaking on CNN, was asked if he was in danger of losing moderate voters.
Is there a concern that the pressure from Santorum and Gingrich might force the governor to tack so far to the right it would hurt him with moderate voters in the general election?
Well, I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an etch-a-sketch. You can kind of shake it up and we start all over again.
Such comments reveal the cynical political game that relies on voters' short-term memory come election season. President Obama, having made a number of significant unfulfilled promises to his base while running for election 4 years ago, is likely to bank on the same sort of memory loss this time around. Many Americans have found little political gratification in either of the two major political parties this election, and 30% of voters simply identify as independent. So-called third parties that are independent of the two major parties struggle to capture enough attention, particularly from the media. Among them is the Green Party, whose presidential candidates for the 2012 elections include Jill Stein, a trained physician, and Roseanne Barr, actor and political activist. Prominent local political figure and staunch progressive Marcy Winograd recently switched from the Democratic to the Green Party. Winograd ran multiple times for a congressional seat in California's 36th District. Spurred by the president's signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, Winograd explained, quote, "If I could not ask someone to join the Democratic Party, I could not in good conscience stay in the party, even as an insurgent writing resolutions and platform planks to end our wars for oil." The Green Party takes strong positions on issues dear to progressives. Presidential candidate Stein has claimed her Green Deal jobs initiative, quote, ends the unemployment problem, it ends the recession, it jumpstarts the secure green economy for the 21st century, and it substantially combats climate change. Other Green Party positions include an end to the war on drugs, the legalization legalization of drugs and support of addiction treatment, as well as ending racial disparities on policing and sentencing and eliminating the privatized prison system. Joining me in studio this morning are two guests. Mike Malinin is a Green Party member and lifelong environmentalist who has worked for Greenpeace and volunteered for a number of other environmental causes. He also happens to be the drummer for the rock band The Goo Goo Dolls. Welcome to Uprising, Mike.
Well, thanks.
Also with us, Marcy Winograd, who ran for Congress, as I mentioned, several times here in Southern California. She is formerly with the Progressive Democrats of America, now a member of the Green Party and co-coordinator of the Santa Monica Greens. She's also an English teacher. Welcome back to Uprising, Marcy.
Oh, thank you so much for having us, Sonali. Great to be here.
Well, first, let me ask the two of you why you are both with the Green Party. Marcy, let me start with you. I mentioned that the NDAA, this Defense Authorization Act that President Obama signed on New Year's, is what prompted you to leave the party. You're somebody who's been long identified, however, with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And there's been for many years this struggle about bringing the Democratic Party leftward versus giving up on the Democratic Party and trying to make it with the Green Party.
Yes, and I don't think there's an easy answer. I think reasonable and intelligent people can disagree on this. I have written an article called Building a Blue-Green Coalition that was published in LA Progressive online, also the California Progress Report, in which I talk, Sonali, about the viability of Green Party members really campaigning at the local level for municipal radicalism, for implementing policies at the local level that we can't begin to implement nationally, but to also look to supporting progressive Democrats like Norman Solomon, who's running up north for Congress, a stellar anti-war candidate. Others may disagree with me within the party, but that's my approach. I just felt that there is a place for an insurgency within the Democratic Party, and we certainly know that I was involved in that for many years. I think there's value to that. At the same time, I think people have to find where they're comfortable, where they can sit and live in their skin. And at this point in history, with the passage of the NDAA, with the suspension of due process, multiple secret CIA drone attacks and wars underway throughout the world, I just feel, look, I want to be authentic. I want to look to the future. I want to be part of something positive. And we know that this empire is not sustainable at some point, and it may be very soon it's going to collapse, or we may be witnessing the collapse right now. Let's plan for our future, a much brighter future. I want to be part of that change.
Well, Mike Malinin, the straw that broke the camel's back for you was Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that is now, whose after effects are now being seen throughout our election season. Tell us about that.
Well, it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for me. It proved that nothing is ever going to change within the two-party system of the parties that are running things right now, obviously. And I can't blame the Democrats or the Republicans, but now they obviously have to go where the money is. And the money is with, obviously, these super PACs and these 11 or 12 people that are giving a day's wages, which is millions and millions of dollars for them, to be buying politics. And I agree with Marcy. It's time to look for something positive. And having actively worked, I've actively worked on the last three Democratic campaigns, starting with Al Gore. My band actually played shows for Al Gore, shows for Kerry, played a show for Obama here. And it's just time to actually try to grow something that can actually cause change in this country. And I think that the only way to do it is to bring in some viable third parties. And for me, the Green Party is most of my opinions actually agree with theirs, so more so than any other party. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important now to actually grow these parties. Like I say, that's why the Green Party now is going for a massive registration drive, trying to get the numbers up.
Right.
Because if the numbers of the participants get up and the number of registered Greens goes up, then the dialogue will change. And that's one thing that Marcy was so good at when she ran for Congress. She changed the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so important right now. So
Organizing a fundraiser tonight, benefit for the Green Party. Tell us briefly about that.
Well, I actually was contacted by the Green Party through Twitter, good old social media. They found me that way because I was tweeting a few things about the party. And we started talking and we had this idea for putting this benefit together. The Green Party isn't as organized in Los Angeles as it would like to be. So hopefully this is the beginning of getting some people together, registering some more Greens and making a little bit of money for the party.
So it's happening tonight at the V Lounge in Santa Monica, 2020 Wilshire Boulevard, and featuring Glenn Phillips, singer of Toad the Wet Sprocket. John Resnick is also going to be there. And who else will be there? It's going to be some pretty well-known folks.
Yes, yeah. Lily Hayden of Venetian. She's in Venice. Violinist will be there with Vivek Mandala. And a number of other great musicians.
Yeah, Nick Luke is playing a band called Christ vs. Warhol. They're kind of a punk rock band. It's their first time to ever play acoustic. It's an all-acoustic show tonight, so that should be interesting.
A punk rock band playing acoustic. Well, so people can just show up at the door and buy tickets?
Yeah, they can. And they can. I'm not sure if they can buy them in advance anymore. I think yesterday was the last day. But you can go to cagreens.org. And it'll give you information on the benefit.
And I think you actually can still buy tickets in advance. So I would urge anyone who's listening who wants to definitely get in to do that. I think we're going to have a big crowd tonight.
So, Marcy, let's talk about what Mike brought up, which is just getting people registered as Greens. There's also an event happening this weekend to help people register.
Yes, there are two other events that are underway. Friday, March 23rd at the Mayflower Club in the Valley on Victory Boulevard at 7 p.m. I believe Roseanne Barr will be there. I will also be talking, and that's a rally in the Valley to register voters for the Green Party. And then on Saturday at the Levantine Center from 10 to 2, located at 5998 West Pico between La Cienega and Crescent Heights, we're going to be doing voter registration training where we train and then we go out and practice. We actually register voters in Los Angeles, come back and debrief. So I'd like to invite anybody who's interested to join us Saturday as well.
And the event that is happening tonight is still something you can buy tickets to online at cagreens.org. It might sell out, so people should go and if they want to support the Green Party and watch a great show. It's happening tonight from 7 to 10 p.m. at the V Lounge, 2020 Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica. So let's talk about some of the issues at stake here. There are a number of issues that the Green Party takes positions on that do coincide with a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and probably a lot of people who are registered Democrat who are listening now are with the Green Party in spirit. So the challenge becomes getting them to, for you, becomes getting them to switch parties and say no more with the two major parties.
Well, that's what's so key right now. There are 113,000 registered Greens in California currently. I'd like the number to go up to a quarter of a million within the next couple of years, and I don't see it as an unreasonable goal. And one of the things in California, there are open primaries. I mean, if it's a Democrat who says, well, I have to vote Democrat because I don't want a Republican to win, which is standard on both sides, right, then it doesn't affect it if you register as a Green. You can register as a Green in principle and then vote for whoever you want in a national election. So that's important. Like I say, it's about getting the number of registered voters up that are registered Green, basically to change the dialogue. It'll become much more obvious to the Democratic Party if all of a sudden there's 250,000, 500,000, a million Greens in California. It's going to change things.
Right. And Marcy, what about politics at the local level? How can Green Party activists what do you think should be a viable Green Party strategy at the local level?
Well, there are some structural changes that I think would really advance third parties in California and beyond. And that one of those is instant runoff voting, proportional representation. So we came close in Los Angeles. We had a number of city council candidates who did support instant runoff voting. We still need to get that passed, and not only in L.A., but in other areas such as Long Beach. So that's one structural change. But I think at the local level, for example, in Santa Monica, Greens are actively supporting a resolution that the city council just passed and an ordinance that the city staff is working on for a sustainability bill of rights, which basically says, look, we want to set very specific goals for energy independence, food independence. We want to recognize the rights of nature, the rights of people to live in sustainable communities. This directly challenges Citizens United. Will it stand in the courts? Well, that's something that has to be tested, but certainly the people need to rise up and resist. So that's one thing that we're doing locally. But around California, if you look at the numbers, in the last few years, we've had a lot of success with local elections, nonpartisan offices, the mayor in Richmond who's gone after Chevron successfully, who has provided a disincentive for banks to foreclose in Richmond. We have the majority of the Fairfax City Council, which is a Green council. We have a representative in Northern California in Humboldt who's protecting the watershed from privatization. So certainly in Northern California, we know that the Green Party is strong, and we want to make it just as strong in Southern California by looking at nonpartisan offices as well as partisan offices. And as long as I'm mentioning that, we do have some candidates already for the U.S. House of Representatives in the June 5th primary, Michael Powelson in District 30, David Steinman, District 33, Anthony Vaira in District 35, and for State Assembly, Jack Lindblad in the 39th District.
And we list those on our website, uprisingradio.org. Let's talk about the national level. This year is, of course, the presidential election year. There are two candidates vying for the Green Party nomination. There's going to be a convention in July where that will get decided, Jill Stein and Roseanne Barr. Stein is a trained physician. Roseanne Barr is an actor and an activist. And I wonder, you know, how you sort of see people's, how you attract mainstream Americans or even mainstream progressive Americans. Mm-hmm. As Romney's campaign manager was asked about whether his party was veering too far to the right, Roseanne Barr is somebody who has openly embraced the so-called 9/11 truth movement. Is that a cause for concern?
You know, Sally, I think Sonali, people can have individual opinions. It's certainly not the position of the California Green Party or the Green Party nationally that 9/11 was an inside job or conspiracy. I certainly would support reopening that investigation. But I don't think that one person necessarily with a particular position on this speaks for the party as a whole. And I would hope that whoever does represent the Green Party in the presidential race would represent the platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well put.
And so let's talk about from here on, between now and November, very briefly then, the registration drives are what the two of you are focused on in California and in Southern California in particular. How can people get involved? Is there a local office that they should contact or just go to CA Greens?
Yeah. I mean, the web obviously is a great tool for it. They can come to the benefit tonight.
That's right.
Sure.
Meet a lot of
tonight.
Us that way.
And join us this weekend, as I mentioned, Friday night at the Mayflower Club in the Valley on Victory, and then Saturday at the Levantine Center from 10 to 2, where we will be doing voter registration training.
But you don't need a registration drive to do it. I just one day said, all right, it's time. Went to the post office and grabbed a voting form and re-registered.
And the other thing to keep in mind is that we have a number of green clubs. Mm-hmm. For example, in Santa Monica, we're reviving our Santa Monica Greens. And anyone in any part of Los Angeles, in any neighborhood, can launch their own club.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. Mike Malinin, Green Party member, and, of course, Marcy Winograd, who ran with the Democratic Party for Congress, is now a Green Party member. Mike Malinin, also drummer for the rock band The Goo Goo Dolls, is organizing an event tonight benefiting the Green Party, featuring Glenn Phillips and John Resnick, Lily Hayden, and many others. You can find out more at cagreens.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Sonali.
And for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Henry David Thoreau once said, it takes two to speak the truth, one to speak and another to hear. That's Thoreau. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Leonardo Alanis is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org. Send us your story ideas at mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.